Today we're going to be talking about label supply in a bit more detail. In the last class we talked about the determinants of the equilibrium quantity of labor supplied at a given wage. Today we're going to examine how that changes in response to other factors. One of the things we'll talk about is the concept of the reservation wage, which is the lowest wage offer that someone is just willing to accept to induce them to start working. We'll examine the effect of changes in non-labor income and the substitution and income effects that result from changes in the wage rate. Last time we talked a bit about indifference curves. Today, one of the things we can note is that the slope of an indifference curve at a given point is a measure of the opportunity cost of leisure time. In particular, the slope is a measure of the additional amount of income that's required to induce someone to give up an additional hour of leisure. When indifference curves are relatively steep, this suggests that the value of time in non-market activities is relatively high. Relatively flat indifference curves indicate that an individual would have a relatively low value of time in alternative activities. Corner solution occurs when the equilibrium point for an individual occurs at one of the corners of the budget constraint. In this case, and the most common type of corner solution occurs when the optimum point occurs at the lower corner. In this case, corner corresponding to a left of corner on the lower right-hand portion of the budget constraint, which corresponds to 0 hours of work. In this case, we can note that the highest level of utility occurs at 0 hours of work. That's how we can tell it is the solution. Notice that utility increases as we move from U0, U1 to U2, while the level of utility at U3, or the indifference curve corresponding to U3, is preferred to U2, it's not feasible. The highest level of utility that can be achieved given this particular budget constraint occurs at the point corresponding to T hours of leisure and 0 hours of work. There's a little red dot on the budget constraint indicating that point. In order for this sort of solution to occur, I think a bit of inspection of this diagram, a little bit of thought, would suggest that an individual stops working when the opportunity cost of leisure is relatively high and or the market wage is relatively low. In other words, people will choose not to work if the value of time is higher in alternative activities than it is in work. This could be because either the individual has a very high alternative value of time, or because the value of their time in the market is not particularly high. The absolute value of the slope of the indifference curve corresponding to 0 hours of work is referred to as the individual's reservation wage, expressed in real terms. The reason for this being the reservation wage is that, remember, the absolute value of the slope of the indifference curve is a measure of the value of leisure time in terms of the additional income required to induce the person to give up an hour of work. If we measure the slope of the indifference curve at a point, the absolute value of that slope is the minimum payment that's required to just compensate for the loss in the value of leisure time. In this diagram, I've drawn a budget constraint, or we've drawn a little tangent line that's just tangent to the indifference curve at the point corresponding to 0 hours of work, at the point where L equals T and H equals 0. If the budget constraint is steeper than the slope of the indifference curve at this point, as illustrated here, if the green line is the slope of the budget constraint, the red line is the slope of the indifference curve at that point, we can see that the budget constraint would lie above the indifference curve U2 in some region. The tangency would occur at some point in this region where the green line, the budget constraint, lies above the indifference curve U2, and as we can see, that would correspond to a value of leisure that's less than T and a positive hours of work. On the other hand, if the budget constraint is flatter than the slope of the tangent line to the indifference curve at the point corresponding to 0 hours of work, or if the real wage is less than the reservation wage, the individual will choose to not work. In this case, there is no point preferred to the point L equals T and H equals 0. As we can see, there is no point that's does better than the point with the red dot on it, the point at which the indifference purview 2 just touches the budget constraint at the corner. Up to this point, we've assumed that individuals receive all their income from labor income. On the other hand, as we noted in the very beginning of the course, individuals receive income from other sources. The other income we've talked about is referred to as unearned income. And by unearned income, we just mean any income that's not received from labor sources. Unearned income may take the form of interest payments, rent, rental income, dividend payments, profits, alimony payments, transfer payments from the government or from parents, from relatives, and so on, lottery winnings, lawsuit settlements. Basically, any form of income that does not vary with hours worked would be considered to be non-labor income or unearned income. We're going to simplify this by defining the variable A to represent the total amount of non-labor income. You can think of A as representing the level of asset income, income which is independent of hours worked. Once we've introduced this non-labor income, the time and goods constraint we talked about last time have to be modified a little bit. The time constraint is the same as before, that hours of work plus hours of leisure add up to the total amount of time available, or H plus L equals T, as we see in equation 1. The goods constraint is the part that has to be modified. Now there's two sources of income, labor income and non-labor income. The left-hand side of the goods constraint provides a measure of the total amount of income received by the individual. WH is the amount of income earned in the labor market, A is the amount of non-labor income. And according to this constraint, total income will equal total spending, which is again equal to the price index for goods and services consumed times the quantity index of the amount of goods and services consumed. This appears in equation 2. Now, using the same type of algebraic manipulation we used before, we first take the time constraint and solve it for H. Then we substitute this, the H equals T minus L, into equation 2, into the goods constraint, and we end up with W times the quantity T minus L plus A is equal to PY. Solving this equation for Y results in the new budget constraint, which tells us that Y is equal to the negative, the real wage, W over T, times L, plus WT plus A, that whole quantity, divided by P. An inspection of this budget constraint indicates that the slope equals a negative W over P, as in the simple model, and the intercept equals the quantity WT plus A divided by P. We can see that by noting that we've already solved for Y here in the standard slope intercept form, Y equals MX plus B, where Y is a variable on the vertical axis, X is a variable on the horizontal axis, M is the slope, and B is the intercept on the vertical axis. In this case, Y on the left-hand side is what corresponds to Y. The variable on the horizontal axis, the X variable, is L, and therefore the coefficient multiplying L, the term negative W over P, the real wage, the negative of the real wage, is the slope. The last term, the WT plus A, the whole quantity divided by P, is the intercept on the vertical axis, corresponds to the B term in the Y equals MX plus B definition. Now we've drawn three budget constraints corresponding to alternative levels of non-labor income. The first one, the lowest one, corresponds to a level of non-labor income of 0, when A equals 0. And we're back to the same budget constraint we had worked with before. The intercept on the vertical axis is WT over P. The intercept on the horizontal axis is L equals T. This is exactly the same budget constraint we worked with earlier. And in fact, I think this should suggest that this more general, that the model we discussed earlier is a special case of this more general model corresponding to 0 level of non-labor income. But as you can see, as the level of A increases from A0 to A1, we end up with an increase in the level of, or the budget constraint shifts vertically upward. And as it shifts vertically upward, we have a new budget constraint with a higher intercept. The slope, of course, stays the same. Well, the Gary Lee just noted that the slope of the budget constraint stays the same when non-labor income rises. While the budget constraint shifts upward as non-labor income rises, it still terminates, however, at T hours of leisure. The reason is that we no longer, that even though you may be receiving income from other sources, there's still only a total of T hours available. That no matter how much income you receive in the stock market or from bonds or rental income or other sources, there's still only going to be 24 hours available in a day. Now, adding some indifference curves to this, we can see that if leisure is a normal good, as apparently occurs here, as the level of real income rises, as the level of non-labor income rises, the level of leisure time consumed rises, that the equilibrium will shift to the right as we move to higher and higher levels of non-labor income. Which is consistent with our earlier discussion in the last class, where we noted that as the level of income rises, the level of the quantity of leisure consumed would increase, assuming that leisure is a normal good. This change in hours worked that results from a change in real income, holding the relative price of labor and leisure time constant, is called a pure income effect. And as we noted, when leisure is a normal good, the income effect will reduce hours worked when income rises, because as leisure time rises, hours of work falls, as is illustrated on the labels on the horizontal axis of this diagram. Now, let's look at the effect of a change in the wage rate. As the wage rate increases, the budget constraint pivots upward, becomes steeper. The intercept on the horizontal axis remains constant at T. The intercept, though, rises from W0T over P to W1T over P when the wage rate increases from W0 to W1. The tangency point shifts, though, from point A to point C here in this diagram. And as we can see, this is going to result in this particular case, in an increase in the amount of leisure time and a reduction in hours worked. In this case, therefore, from our earlier discussion, it must be the case that the income effect is larger in magnitude than the substitution effect. Here, we've broken up the total change from point A to C into two separate components. The first is a substitution effect, and the second is the income effect. Now, what we've done here is we've tried to illustrate the change in the mix of L and Y that results from a change in the relative price of leisure holding utility constant. This is what we call the substitution effect. That's represented from a movement from point A to point B in this diagram. The budget constraint that's tangent to the indifference curves at point B is a hypothetical budget constraint. It's not one that's actually observed. It was constructed by taking the original indifference curve, taking the level of utility that the individual was initially at, and finding where the individual would be at if relative prices changed to the new level, holding the level of utility constant at this level. In this case, one way of thinking about it is we constructed a new budget constraint that's parallel to the one that goes through point C, but is tangent to the original indifference curve. And that occurs at point B. And as we can see here, that whenever the real wage rises, the absolute value of the slope of the budget constraint becomes larger. And given the convexity of indifference curves, the only point where an individual will move to as a result of this pure substitution effect has to be above and to the left of the original point. So when the real wage rises, the individual will consume less leisure and will work more hours as a result of the substitution effect. The shift from point B to C, it should be obvious, is perfectly analogous to the pure income effect that we discussed earlier, that it's a parallel shift in the budget constraint, holding relative prices constant or holding the real wage constant at the new level. And if leisure is a normal good, this will result in more leisure being consumed and fewer hours of work. On the other hand, in the last case we just talked about, the income effect was larger than the substitution effect. Here, another alternative has been illustrated in which the income effect is smaller in magnitude than the substitution effect. As before, the substitution effect is represented by movement from point A to B in response to a higher real wage. and the income effect is represented by the movement from point B to C. Since the leftward shift from point A to B is larger than the rightward shift from point B to C, the substitution effect is the larger of the two, and the net effect is that this individual would choose to work more hours and would consume less leisure when the wage rate rises. This individual would be operating in an upward sloping portion of their labor supply curve. Now, in noting all of this, it's important to note that we can never really observe individual income and substitution effects in response to a wage rate change. That all we really observe is a movement from point A to C. We only observe the combined income and substitution effects and not the individual components. So, while we never observe this, however, I suppose we should note that it is useful to make this, to decompose this change into separate substitution and income effects so that we can understand why a backward-bending labor supply curve might exist.